Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It is Monday, March 9th. Congresswoman Jill Tekuda is back in Honolulu following a failed vote in the House to limit the president's war powers. We catch up on the impacts of the war in Iran and efforts to provide relief for farmers from on-again, off-again, on-again tariffs. We also continue our look around the islands at immigration enforcement, what's been playing out on Maui. We catch up on measures aimed at making it easier for pet owners to find homes that welcome their furry companions, too. And outreach workers are at a stanza with the homeless community living in floating shelters along Kehi Lagoon in Kalihi. And a celebration of the U.S. Navy comes to Honolulu and Hilo for the first time in the event's history. What to expect from Navy Week. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Congresswoman Jill Tekuda just returned from our nation's capital. She's kicking off a series of town hall meetings this week. She stopped by this morning to get us up to speed on the latest developments from the war in Iran to the talks to end the partial government shutdown and more. Here's Tekuda.
These are difficult times, and I think we just have to, as difficult as it is, remember, let's live with aloha. Let's give ourselves and others grace right now. Tensions are high. People are afraid. We've got a war going on. It was not a war of any of our choosing. It was one man's choosing, the president. But we find ourselves in the situation now where every morning we wake up, read the paper, innocent lives lost. People scared, trying to escape the Middle East. Innocent Americans right now fleeing. The price of gas going up because we're now over $100 a barrel in terms of oil. And as we sadly know here in Hawaii, the war on affordability is being lost as we get distracted by wars outside this country. And so as difficult as it is, we've got to make sure that we continue to live with aloha, act with aloha, and again, give ourselves and others some grace as we go through these difficult times.
And the House vote failed last week. Just concern about how we got pulled into this situation. And then I know the Star Advertiser had a report today about possibly one of our subs being involved. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been verified by IndoPaycom, but just certainly underscores the connection with all of us.
Yeah. No, it continues to be. We're Hawaii. We're not 6 degrees of separation from anything. We are always very close. And when you consider how many service members are kama'aina, how many service members live and serve based here in Hawaii, when we're talking about a war like this, the first place your mind goes to is, are people going to be okay? We know that too many are going to be called up and be boots on the ground. We're praying for their safety. We think about the lives lost and remembering, for me, during the last big war that we had and Hawaii giving out, I don't know if you're called those Medal of Honors, the Hawaii Medal of Honors. I remember having to sit through hours as we went through over 100 every session. The tears, the young widows, the children, the babies, the pregnant moms. We can't have that happen again. And at the same time, we've got Carolyn Leavitt from the White House press secretary saying, you can't rule out the draft. Everything's on the table. And so, you know, all of this is literally close to home for so many people here in Hawaii. For myself, as the mother of two teenage boys, this is very up close and personal. We have got to remember that when we fight to take back our war powers authority with Congress. This is not about one man. This is not about him. This is about us making sure we protect and we be the voice for the people who elected us into office, our constituents. And if we do our job in upholding the Constitution, we should have passed that war powers resolution. We're going to have to try again, quite frankly, because we cannot allow that to be let go. And then if you think about just the billions of dollars being spent, billions, they're estimating it could be $1 billion at least a day spent on this war. And I think about how we could better use those billions of dollars to help make sure people have health care, because we left that on the table. We never we didn't do anything about that. I think about how it could be used to put food on the table when we cut $200 billion from SNAP EBT and that big ugly bill last summer. You know, it could make sure that little children have full bellies when they go to school. I think about farmers and small businesses struggling with tariff. We could finally give them some relief. $1 billion of the day should be going to somewhere else other than a prolonged war in which we see no way out.
And I think there is some cause for concern about what could happen in our backyard with all the attention now on the other side of the hemisphere, and whether that makes us less safe, or what are your thoughts on that?
I think you hit on the head right there. Americans have to, and people here in Hawaii have to ask themselves, do they fear safer today than when all of this started? Do they feel safer? I can tell you, I don't feel safer. The president himself has admitted that more service members could die. When asked the questions, do you think Americans should be concerned about terrorist attacks or anything happening at home? He said, I guess. Americans are not safer because of everything going on in the Middle East, because the president decided to throw us into war right now. And we look even at our own doorstep to the Pacific, the Indo-Pacific. We're blowing off a good portion of our stockpile in the Middle East right now. Prior to that, we were bombing shipping boats near Venezuela. We do not, contrary to the president's opinion, have endless supplies of missiles and defensive armaments. And he's already moved a lot of our service members, our destroyers and other things towards that region. It leaves us, to me, ill-prepared for the real threat that is China.
And there is concern because we are still in a partial government shutdown. I don't know where that is. It seems to have been lost with the headlines over the last 2 weeks.
I feel like this president uses war as a distraction. Whether it's war, whether it's bombing Venezuela, whether it's capturing dictators and bringing them to the U.S., violating international law, he uses that as a red herring and distraction from the real work at home. He should absolutely be focused right now on working with Congress to reopen government, which, by the way, we can do it right now. We can open up Department of Homeland Security if they commit to actually their mission of keeping the homeland safe, not executing Americans literally in our streets. All we're asking for is take off the masks, wear body cameras, fair investigations, and most importantly, real warrants. I don't think a lot of folks in our country realize it. The warrants that are being used are administrative warrants. Get a judge. Would you want someone busting through your door with some desk jockey just signing off saying, okay, it's all right, and violating your rights, violating your privacy, doing all of these different things? They're basic things that we're asking for, and we could be in 100% agreement, and we can reopen Department of Homeland Security. And the sad part is we are in agreement. We've said that from day one. We've got bills up there. Go ahead. Let's fund CISA. Let's fund FEMA. Let's fund TSA and the Coast Guard. This one, Customs and Border Patrol and ICE, they need the guardrails, and they refuse. They're holding the other divisions hostage because they refuse to put guardrails on this one agency.
Yeah, and so there are some who, you know, might think, yeah, we've got to protect our borders and do more about immigration. And I know you visited the Federal Detention Center earlier this year and talked to some of the people that were being detained there. And as I talked to immigration attorneys, they say, we've had clients in there for 4 months. We just connected with Miss Hawaii, Cheryl Bartlett. Friday, she texted me to say, hey, you know, my husband has been reunited here. He's arrived in Brazil. So after 4 months, what can you share with us about what's happening there?
They've been claiming that it's all about the worst of the worst. Murderers, rapists, drug dealers, all of these things. When I went to our federal detention center, I didn't see the worst of the worst. In some cases, people literally were seeking asylum. Their family members had fought alongside Americans. They'd been brought to this country. They checked in regularly. They'd been brought in, and they were being detained right there in the detention center. This is not the worst of the worst. I watched with people crying in front of me as they shared with me letters from their pastors talking about how they've given back to their community. Even parole officers saying this person committed a crime decades ago, but they've been good and they're giving back and contributing. So many stories you will never hear about from this administration that actually they're locking up and they're deporting and they're striking fear in the hearts of good people, many of whom their crime was trying to seek a better life and give back to this country and make it home. If it's about the worst of the worst, I'm all for that. I'm all for that. If it's about actually protecting our borders and immigration reform, I'm all for that. But that's not what they're doing here. This is not about immigration reform. This is not about securing our borders. Take a look at where they're putting thousands of ICE officers and deploying out CBP officers as well. It's not even at the border. Minneapolis was not a border threat. And yet, sadly, that is where we saw some of the worst things happen.
Well, do you have another trip plan to the detention center? Because it just seems difficult to get information. We have people saying, yeah, the operation seems to be they move people around from place to place so that the immigration attorneys have a very difficult time tracking people.
I mean, even language is an issue. I would tell you that sitting down with a few dozen folks, there were more languages being spoken than I could ever imagine. And we had no ability to translate in there. I didn't have my phone, couldn't even use Google Translate to be able to translate. So there's a lot of issues. We do plan on going back soon. One of the requests actually that came in when I met with the state legislators was whether or not we could try to organize a visit for them to go. And so that is something that I would like to be working on. I know they're literally in the middle of session and debating a lot of bills right now. I think it's important they also go in and see. And so our office is constantly working with folks and their attorneys to try to make sure that we get them as much help as we possibly can. But I will definitely be planning a visit in the near future. And actually, one that, again, what I'd like to do is to be able to take some of our state lawmakers that are interested in going, be able to take them in there as well.
And then I know that you are kicking off a number of town hall meetings. Have you been working a lot on the farm bill? Anything you can share about any relief that our farmers can see?
It was a tough week last week on a number of fronts. We negotiated the farm bill for 23 hours. I can tell you one of the biggest thing I was pushing for, and I took it all the way to multiple procedural votes. I've been trying to actually repeal all tariffs from agriculture inputs, your fuel, your feed, your equipment, your fertilizer, all of these different things, your seed that you need right now has been tariffed to death, if you will. $8 billion is the estimate of how much farmers paid for on these agriculture input tariffs last year alone. And that's just taxes. That's taxes on our farmers. It's taxes on additional cost to the food that you eat. So I've been trying to actually trying to pass an amendment to the farm bill to say, remove all ag inputs. And I know the courts did a little, but the president turned around and imposed a 15% global tariff. Let's get rid of all those tariffs and taxes on our food producers so our food can be cheaper. So that was one of the big fights that I fought and sadly took it to many votes, lost that one. I was trying to actually get some relief for rural hospitals to get some money from the federal government to be able to pay for staffing to keep doors open. That also sadly failed. And I was trying to restore $660 million to the local food for schools program that, as we know, last year, Secretary Rollins cut. She cut $1 billion from school food and food pantries, trying to get that restored. That sadly also failed. We're going to keep trying because think about it. If we can spend $1 billion a day on war, can't we spend $660 million to make sure local kids can eat good food from farmers right in their backyard? Can't we make sure that pantries have shelves that are stocked to feed the hungry and many of the working poor right here in Hawaii? And can't we give a little relief to our farmers who are growing our food and can barely put food on their own? We've got to do better.
Yeah. Last week was also tough because we lost former Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa. Anything you want to share about that?
I know a lot of folks, if they just watch the TV, they saw a hard ass. And she was, right? She didn't back down. She was a fighter. She was straight out of Waianae. And she was the first female Senate president. It was very proud to be able to enter the state Senate at the same time she took that office. But at the end of the day, I would tell you, she had heart. It was all about heart for Colleen. She was tough as nails. She was smarter than anyone. But it was always her heart, I think, that she led with. And I definitely miss my mentor and my friend. And just so blessed that I could have had a chance to serve with her in the state Senate. And she left her mark in Congress, as you might remember as well. So I've had a lot of folks reaching out after they got the news, sharing stories, and also missing their friend that served Hawaii well in Congress.
Yeah. Anything else that you want to share with our listeners that we haven't covered? I don't know.
Just stay tuned. We are continuing our statewide town hall series. I'm doing a number of listening sessions as well. As you know, we did some town halls at the beginning of this year. I'm continuing on now more on Oahu. I've got Maui. Literally, we'll be on Molokai in Lanai and in Lahaina as well in the next month or so. We're doing listening sessions with veterans. They literally asked for their own. They said, we have real specific issues. We want you to come talk to us about veterans issues. So I'll be doing that on Oahu and Kauai later this week as well. And I've even got a listening session we will be planning for federal employees. Again, my whole goal is to meet people where they're at. And that means reaching out. That means sitting down around common tables and talking and figuring out what action we're going to take together. And so stay tuned for that. Visit our website, tokuda.house.gov, for our upcoming events that we've got, hopefully in a community near you.
Okay. All right. Congresswoman Takuda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from Congresswoman Jill Takuda on concerns ranging from the war in Iran to the partial government shutdown. And we will have more information about the upcoming town hall meetings on our website after the show.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
HPR is inviting you to a special Live from the Atherton Storytellers event celebrating 65 years of Hawaii Youth Opera Chorus. Our own DJ Mermaid will discuss opera in Hawaii with choral director Nola Nahulu. Plus, special performances from the Youth Opera Chorus. Join us Saturday, March 28th at 2 p.m. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
You know, we've been reaching out to get updates on immigration enforcement actions across the state. We heard from Kauai County Council Member Fern Holland last week following an immigration raid last fall that led to 44 arrests. Today we hear from longtime Maui immigration attorney Kevin Block. He says enforcement activity on Maui has changed dramatically. His clients are skipping medical appointments and reducing their inter-island travel out of fear. Block spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender.
I think the difference that we've seen lately is both there's a new that we've never seen before sort of carceral element to the deportation process. So it has always been the case as long as I've been practicing and probably even before that, that a person that there was a process for anybody who's been here for 2 years or more has the right under due process to try to make their case in immigration court as to whether they have any type of relief that will allow them to stay, right? So they may be eligible for asylum. They may have a family member who could petition them. They may have been here for 10 years or more and may be eligible for cancellation of removal. That process, it's flawed, but it's also, it's how our laws work. It's kind of orderly, and usually, even though the process is flawed and takes a long time, it actually works. Like people who I represented who deserved to get asylum because they really faced a legitimate danger if they returned to their country of origin were, because of the way the process filters folks, they actually won their asylum cases. And if folks came for economic reasons or came for reasons that didn't quite rise to the level of the very high bar of asylum, they didn't win their cases and they ultimately had to go back. And so I think the difference now is that there's two things. One thing is that now we have a bunch of new laws and cases that allow for a person to be held in custody while their application or their court case proceeds. And that's a problem because the immigration violations are civil. So we don't, there's no other area in the law where we imprison people who are being charged with something civilly. But in now, under the current interpretations of INA 235 and under these couple of these new cases, if a person is in proceedings trying to apply for asylum or has entered without an inspection, even if it was 20 years ago and has been living here this entire time, they may show up for an appointment at USCIS or ICE and be taken into custody. And then they're told, hey, if you want to continue to fight your case, you're welcome to do that, but you're going to be sitting here in the federal detention center in Honolulu by the airport who knows how long. Like, if you lose your case in immigration court and you file an appeal, that can take a year or more. And so what it does is it encourages, or it sort of incentivizes people to not really exercise their full due process rights, but to just be like, well, you know what? I don't really want to fight my case anymore. I want to leave because I can't, if I'm sitting here in the federal detention center, I can't have access to my lawyer. I can't see my family. I can't work. So maybe I'll just go back. And a lot of times they're making the choice to go back to countries where they legitimately have faced persecution because of something that's particular to them. Like, they have legitimate asylum cases, but mm-hmm. they're just like, well, I'll just take my chances and go back.
Has that happened to any of your clients?
Yeah, it's happened to some of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the other big difference, so the carceral nature, the increased amount of people in custody is one big difference. The other big difference is, yeah, there were a lot of deportations during the Obama administration and even during Trump 1 and then even during Biden. But the difference is, and this is kind of hard to explain, but this is what I see firsthand being on the front lines. Immigrants in general come from countries and cultures where they are pretty good at following rules, and they're not super, like, I don't know how to explain this, but they don't, it is not necessary to kick down doors with machine guns out and your face covered in a mask. A lot of times with immigrants, if you tell them, hey, you're in immigration proceedings now, you have a notice to appear, they're going to show up for court. Like, 99% of my clients show up for their court dates because they follow the rules and they know that this is what they need to do in order to either win or lose their case. And so the idea of treating them all like criminals and the idea that it's necessary to have this, like, aggressive, militarized approach to the enforcement, that's the other big difference now. There may be an equal number of deportations under other administrations, but the difference is the fear that this causes because of how it's being conducted. And it also, just the sort of collective subconscious effect that it has on a large group of people that are our community members and our neighbors, when they're constantly the subject. Like, if you imagine being a young Latino man and seeing on the TV all the time people who look like you being dragged, pregnant women being dragged through the snow and people being, like, handcuffed and little kids being hauled off. And those are the same people that are, like, honestly building our houses and taking care of our kids and taking care of our lawns and cleaning our hotel rooms. So they're part of our community, but we're treating them like animals. And that's the part that I think is different under this administration.
And I mean, we know from the Data Deportation Project, this is for the state of Hawaii, 2025 compared to 2024, I believe, they found that arrests and detentions quadrupled, something right. like that. Of yeah. It's a real marked increase. Are you seeing that on Maui? Do those numbers feel right with your experience?
Yeah, I think there's definitely been an increase. It seems like there's the raids, if you want to call them that, or the operations have been kind of, like, larger in scale and larger in number. I think a lot of the scale is driven by the sort of quotas that they're experiencing to arrest a certain number of people. I heard that the field offices who have the lowest number of per capita arrests or the lowest percentage arrests, will their field office directors will be replaced. So they're kind of, plus they have that 3,000 a day quota. So I think that's what's causing the increase in enforcement all over the United States, but also in Hawaii. And then it also is what's responsible for a lot of the poor police work that we're seeing, the violation of people's constitutional rights, the arresting of people who have status, like those teachers on Maui, those that were dragged out of their house at before dawn, and they were all here legally. And that's the kind of thing that happens when you are rushing to arrest people.
Where's the field office?
It's here on Oahu. So they do most of their enforcement action here because they're here. But every once in a while, like every month or 2 months, they'll fly a group of guys over to either Kona or very rarely Hilo and often Maui. There was that big raid on Kauai that was on the news. So, but yeah, the field office is here at the federal building here on Oahu.
So that seems like it almost produces scenarios where agents go to another island for a limited period of time and there's a huge amount of activity,
right,
punctuated by periods of silence.
Right.
What does that feel like on the ground?
Yeah, so that feels like what it feels like for us on Maui. It's difficult because, like I said, we're still recovering from the fire. Like a lot of people who don't live on Maui are sort of like, what? It's been 2 years. Like, come on, you guys, why is it still? But it's still, you can feel it. Like people are still reeling. Like I live up in Kula where the fire was up in Kula. My house almost burned down. And I still, every time the wind blows, I'm like freaked out. And I still feel, every time I talk about it, I cry. Like it was really hard on us because we're a close community. And so when guys come from a different island and they start plucking people out of your community, it feels weird. It feels like a war. It feels dangerous and cruel. And then what happens too is people won't send their kids to school. They won't go to the hospital if they're sick. They won't go to work if they need to go to work. And that whole failure to participate in civic life really affects the entire community, right? Because like if your kid's teacher, you know, has parents that are undocumented and she's afraid she won't come to work that day, and then your kid's teacher isn't at school that day, or if the kids get taken into custody and then all the other little kids in the class feel it, you know what I mean? So there's a ripple effect. Like we found out during the fire that what happens to part of our community really happens to all of us. I mean, I know that sounds cliche, but we learned that. The whole island was impacted by the fire, whether we were next to it or not. And I think that's kind of what we're feeling about the enforcement activity, that you can feel the way that it, anytime that something creates so much fear and sadness and despair in a part of the community, the rest of the community feels it.
Coconut Wireless will work a little bit differently than it even does here on Oahu. Like that when those big enforcement actions or even just agent activity, that's something that everyone knows about.
Right. So this is where I would give a shout out to Roots Reborn, because that sort of started right in the wake of the fire when myself and a couple other advocates, we were trying to react in real time to certain issues like finding people that were lost or translating really important information into Spanish or other languages, Tagalog, Ilocano, Tongan, the Micronesian languages, for people that desperately needed the information. So right after the fire, I reached out to these young folks that I knew because I did their DACA applications. And I'm like, hey, FEMA is coming over and they have these lists of people that are missing. And they're like, no, we already have our own list. And it's way more accurate because we're from the neighborhood, right? So that's when we realized that in disaster recovery, just like in response to a hostile enforcement framework, the folks that are from the neighborhood are the ones that have the sort of the dog in the fight. And they're the ones that know the relevant important information. They know how to talk to their neighbors about what's going on. So that's how Roots Reborn started. And then recently, you know, after the fire, but when Trump took office in January, we sort of pivoted a little bit in our mission to do more Know Your Rights trainings. And then we initiated and kind of like facilitate a community response program in which we have trained volunteers who are citizens or have status who will respond completely non-confrontationally and non-violently and legally, but they will respond to any report. We have a tip line and we'll respond if we hear that ICE is on our island. And then that response, there's a network of people that are in the area that will go and take pictures and determine if it really is ICE. And if it is, then we push out a notification. And that does two things. One, the obvious thing that it does is that it warns people that they're here and they can take whatever appropriate actions they want. But it also helps us differentiate between the false alarms, because a lot of times because of social media, a police officer will be at Home Depot and everybody's like, ICE is at Home Depot. And if you're trying to lower the temperature of the community and keep people calm, we wanted this process for really verifying these tips and then making sure that they were real. And our program at Roots Reborn has become the model for the Oahu program, which just recently started up. But ours has been in place since the end of last summer, and it works really effectively too. We also provide information to the folks immediately if they're going to get arrested on what's going to happen to them if they're in detention. And we reach out to immigration attorneys to make sure that they have representation once they get to the federal detention center. And then we reach out to their families to kind of tell them what to expect and how to respond when your loved one is in detention. Because that's another one of the big issues, is people, not so much here in Hawaii, but it happens a little bit here in Hawaii too. It's sort of like they don't take your family member and be like, here's a helpful information sheet on what to do next and how to find your father who's now gone. That doesn't happen. And so we try to step into that gap and like tell them, okay, this is how you're going to reach out to them by phone. This is how you put money on their books so that they can call you and email you. This is what you can expect in terms of the court process. So that's kind of what a lot of the things that Roots Reborn has done.
That was Maui immigration attorney Kevin Block talking with HPR's Maddie Bender about the immigration snapshot on Maui. If you own a pet, you may know how challenging it is to find rental housing. Well, today, HPR's Cassie Ordonia joins us to talk about some pet-friendly bills she is tracking down at the state legislature. Good morning.
Morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so these are bills in what, public housing?
Yeah, public housing and affordable housing. And some bills that I've been keeping a close eye on is Senate Bill 3011. And what that bill would do, it would get rid of breed and size restrictions in public housing specifically, and it would open existing public housing to pet owners. Currently, that bill has crossed over from the Senate to the House. And then another bill that I'm monitoring closely is House Bill 1593. And that bill would require that any new affordable housing development that's built by the Hawaii Housing Finance and Development Corporation would have to allow pets. And also the bill would allow that the agency can have restrictions around animal behavior and nuisance issues, but they cannot impose rules on the breed and size of the pet. And for the House bill, it was Representative Andrew Garrett who introduced the House measure. And he said that bill is kind of influenced by how he owns pets. He has about 8 cats and dogs. And he said this is how the requirement would apply to projects funded by the HHFDC.
We're making the argument that because this project receives state funding, there's a compelling state interest in implementing these pet-friendly policies. So these HHFDC projects are, what you might know as a 201H, affordable housing projects. So the state has some skin in the game. They offer tax credits and the like to get these projects off the ground. So we thought this would be a good place to kind of start it out on a pilot basis. And if this can prove successful, that we look at other venues. And ultimately, the goal would be where we don't have legislation needed at all, but just landlords voluntarily recognize that this isn't really the big issue that they might think it is.
Yeah, and so, finding landlords who allow pets in Hawaii, it is tough. It's even tougher for renters in affordable and publicly funded housing. But by federal law, all federally funded public housing has to allow pets. So there is housing in Hawaii that does allow pets, but they have a lot of breed and size restrictions. Some breeds that landlords typically do not allow are the big dogs, such as pit bulls, Rottweilers, German Shepherds, Dobermans, and even Huskies. Others include some reptiles and birds. And specifically for dogs, there are weight limits around 25, 50 pounds per animal. But I spoke with Stephanie Kendrick of the Hawaiian Humane Society on Oahu, and she says the shelter has seen owners give up their pets due to landlord issues. And when I was there last week on the Mo'ili'ili campus, there were about 5 to 7 dogs who were given up by their owners due to landlord issues.
The human-animal bond is so incredibly powerful for those of us who have had those relationships, and it really is having to give up a family member. And so the toll that it takes on families is acute, particularly children, vulnerable people who are struggling with issues, and that pet was their comfort, their companion. For the animals, you know, we do our best here to provide an enriching, loving environment where they're well cared for, but a shelter is not a home. It's stressful. There's a higher likelihood of illness. There's a higher likelihood of behavior distress. And any amount of time that an animal has to spend in a shelter, it takes a toll on that animal. So while that's why we're here and we're happy to be here as that safety net, we would so much rather see animals stay with the people who love them.
And Kendrick also said that there are best practices that can help landlords feel more comfortable with allowing pets.
So what we really recommend is behavior-based policies, both for the pet owner and for the pet. So setting things up where there's mandatory vaccination records, where we have no objections to anyone requiring spay and neuter for the animals moving on to their properties, that can also help with some behavior issues. Meeting the pet and the pet owner and seeing what that relationship is like, asking about the exercise plan for the animal. Is that animal going to be getting enough exercise that it's going to be peaceful while the owner's gone? You know, all of those things, setting up a pet committee so that you can do those things, all of those things go directly to, is this animal and this person going to be a good neighbor in our community? And we really encourage that kind of an approach rather than just setting arbitrary size limits that might wind you up with a whole bunch of unhappy small yappy dogs in your apartment building rather than a chill Great Dane who's just going to spend the day lying on the couch. So I think a lot of times people want a black and white solution to a complex problem. And there isn't one, right? What we want is to open housing as broadly as possible to our community and their entire families. Then you just need to meet people where they are, and you need to set up policies that are designed to make sure that your community is happy and healthy and living well together.
So what does the state say about these proposals?
So the agencies, the Hawaii Public Housing Authority and the HHFDC, they both have raised concerns on both bills, and those concerns about liability issues in case, let's say, a dog bites someone else or another dog, property damages and administrative burden. Those were the main concerns that were brought up during testimony. But the National Apartment Association reported that only 9% of pets are reported to cause damage of any kind, and the average cost of damages is $210.
Okay, we'll see if the lawmakers have an appetite for this. But thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HPR's Cassie Ordonio. You can read her story online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
A houseboat of sorts has become cause for concern for city and state officials because it's become a magnet of problems for problems in the Kehi Stream area. Star Advertiser reporter Dan Nicasso joins us today to talk about what officials plan to do with this situation. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, good. Yeah. So, the Sunday edition had some great pictures of this giant houseboat and the issues that they're dealing with along the stream.
Yeah, great photos by Jam Aquino.
interestingly, this flotilla, there's several boats out there. They don't even have an exact count how many, but it's that age-old problem we've seen in the past with other homeless encampments. There's a state side and a city side. And in this case, these vessels, or if you want to call them that, are able just to float across to the other side if there's a law enforcement action to clean out the area. And right now, it's tied up right near Kawiki Village, which is a kind of a shining example of what the state, city, nonprofits, and private builders were able to do to create a very positive homeless community out there for motivated families. And right next door, you've got this group of people that don't want service, don't want help.
Yeah, and then so some of these are what structures along the shoreline, which we've seen in the past, but some of them are these floating homes, I guess.
Yeah, there's one that's at least two stories, and it's been there a while. And the whole community out there has been out there for about 8 years now and just kind of moving around. And, you know, I think our community and policymakers have evolved to the point of just sweeping large encampments just chases the problem into another community. And on Oahu, of course, and throughout the state, we have all these waterways. So they're really putting in a lot of hope in outreach and trying to get folks to voluntarily leave, which in that case, in that group out there in that Kalihi area, they're pretty chronically homeless, to put it, to use the parlance. They don't really want help. They want to live off the grid. But the problem is they're not just living out there. They're concerned is they're dumping raw human sewage and urine and food and God knows what else into the stream, which goes out into the ocean. And IHS, Institute of Human Services, which operates Kawiki Village, alleges they're also stealing water and power. And it's just not a good example for a community that's in Kawiki Village. It's really motivated to improve their lives. So it's a bit of a juxtaposition, to say the least.
And then the city and state officials give you any timeline as to when they plan to tackle this? Because, I mean, you know, deconstructing that two-story houseboat, I can see, would be a challenge.
Yeah. No timeline. The city has gone on the record saying, you know, they're not in support of a sweep for those same problems that I talked about. So IHS is continuing to send outreach teams down there of social workers to offer, you name it, housing, substance abuse, just a meal, hygiene kits, just to interact. And when you've got a hardcore group that doesn't want to interact and they're physically hard to assess, they're not on a street corner somewhere, they can just push off from the shore, it creates a challenge.
Yeah, and I know we're in for some bad weather. You just really worry that there could be a problem and these vessels could sink, and then it's just compounded.
I mean, they're not seaworthy, right? They don't have proper toilets or anything like that. So, you know, anything could happen. They could break apart, as you said. And of course, the state's been dealing with the problem with this kind of problem out in Kahi Lagoon for years of just people living on these structures. The state's done a pretty good job cleaning out the area, but that's the problem.
Yep.
What happens in a big storm or high tide or big wave action?
Right. Well, hopefully they can address that soon before there are additional problems. But thank you so much, Dan.
You bet. Anytime.
That was Honolulu Star Advertiser reporter Dan Nicasso. Look for his story online at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Pacific Health, committed to raising awareness for Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, helping to prevent colorectal cancer through screenings. HawaiiPacificHealth.org/cancercenters.
On the next Fresh Air, the hidden history of blackface and how amateur minstrel shows featuring white people in blackface permeated American culture in the North and the South. Even President Roosevelt was a fan. We talk with Ray Lynn Barnes, author of Darkology. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Daniel Kahikina Akaka VA Clinic, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
Hawaii is to celebrate Navy Week for the very first time to mark its 250th anniversary. A team of 50 sailors is now on the islands to highlight its history with the stop plan on the Big Island. It's visiting some 15 cities across the continent. We got a chance to talk to Rear Admiral Ryan Mahelona, the Kamehameha Schools and Naval Academy graduate, is returning home to be part of the historic first festivities. It includes activities that begin today and will coincide with the fireworks display as part of the Honolulu Festival, which is marking its 30th anniversary.
So Navy Week is about, it's really about outreaching to the community and making people more aware of the Navy and, you know, some of the things that we've been working on or doing. It's really about connecting with the communities, you know, visiting like veterans' homes and, you know, getting out there so that people understand more about the Navy.
And share with us your journey with the service.
Sure. I actually graduated from Kamehameha Schools and went straight into the U.S. Naval Academy, which is how it all started, right? And didn't really plan on staying in the Navy for this long. But, you know, over time, as I progressed in my career, I've had the opportunity to work with some great mentors who helped me along. And, you know, continue to groom me and groom me into the leader that I am. And so now I'm at that stage in my career where I'm paying it back, so to speak, you know, looking to develop the next generation of new leaders.
And so tell us, what's in store for Navy Week here in Hawaii?
So Navy Week, it's actually going to be done in both Hilo and Honolulu. Usually it's just done in one city. And in this case, it really started out with my visit last year to Hilo. So I'm going back to visit Hilo. It's, you know, I'm getting in touch with some of the civic organizations, just talking with the leaders there, getting in touch with some of the younger executives, upcoming students and children. I'm actually planning to go back to visit my alma mater, both on Hilo, which I haven't been to, and Kapalama, and ending it all with the Honolulu Festival Grand Parade.
Yeah, and folks who, you know, may be familiar with Fleet Week, you know, there are a number of activities that happen during that time. But I guess the whole idea behind Navy Week is what, you sometimes go more inland than you would staying along the shore.
Well, we bring, you know, a group of people with us to help engage with the community and do some of the participating things like picking up trash or, you know, those kinds of things, even building houses. I mean, so we have our own military folks that volunteer to do this kind of thing, and it's a great opportunity for folks to connect.
So talk about the history of the Navy, you know, because we're marking this anniversary, and so many of our services have held, you know, special events, particularly since our country, you know, marks the anniversary on the 4th of July as well.
Oh, for sure. This is a special year celebrating the 250th year. And, you know, it means a lot to both the Navy and the country, obviously, to be able to do this in Hawaii. A lot of history, a lot of integration between Hawaii and the Navy. And so, you know, it's a great opportunity to highlight a lot of those things that it seems like we're inseparable. We continually throughout time, we're integrated with each other.
And so talk about where the Navy has taken you.
The Navy's taken me across the world. I've been able to go to, you know, various countries, Australia. I've been out there to the Middle East, Japan. And it's, you know, geographically, it's been great to be able to see how the other countries are and really appreciate what we grew up with, some of the freedoms that we have. And it's been a great experience for me to go, really humbling to be able to see all of that going around the world.
And I guess as, you know, we reflect on the times right now, we've got the conflict over there in the Middle East. And, you know, right now we've got peace in the Pacific region and we want to, you know, keep secure. But, you know, it can be a fragile thing.
Sure. And I mean, that's the whole purpose of my job is I'm working to keep the American public safe, our family and friends safe. It's what we do and why we do it.
And then, I don't know, is there anything you want to add? I mean, I know that there has been some tension in the local community, you know, just because of the recent things with Red Hill, you know, and just concerns about the cleanup. But, yeah, anything else you want to say about that?
I'll just say that we always have issues to work through, and I think the key to it is ensuring that we collaborate, we talk it out, we have a dialogue, you know, get to that understanding, and that's what partly what leadership does is you get people together to move in the same direction and achieve a common goal.
And then anything more you want to say about the events that we've got coming up here? What are you most looking forward to?
All of it is just fantastic. I'm really excited about it. I get to bring my wife with me, so she gets to experience that as well. And, you know, we are just looking forward to meeting people and talking with people. That's really the highlight of all of this is getting out there, getting to understand, getting to talk, and, you know, to have a good time.
Yeah, you know, and I think as we think and reflect upon our history and, you know, the bombing of Pearl Harbor and what everybody has lived through with the World War II, yeah, and then just how the armed forces, its place in our history in the Pacific region.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, there's been many before me that have served, and you know, including my father and my uncle, my brother. So, you know, there's a lot of families that have served that lived on island, still live on island. And so, you know, certainly, you know, those kinds of events are things we remember, but certainly not lost upon us.
And then the team that you'll be bringing with you, will some of them have ties to Hawaii as well?
I believe a few of them do, actually. I know our public affairs office has ties, and so you know, it's always nice to bring those folks home with us as well so we can enjoy coming back home.
That was Navy's Rear Admiral Ryan Mahelona, who we talked with last week about Navy Week, which officially kicks off today. Look for links to the activities on our website later today. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from the CEO of Bishop Museum. What's Hawaii's connection to groundbreaking possum research? Have an idea to share with us? Call our talkback line 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast by heading to our website or searching for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.